Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1 pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to arrow hit to yoga and mobility to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. This podcast is sponsored by The Nation magazine. I'm Jeet here. I'm a writer for The Nation. And the podcast is also widely available on all podcasting platforms, as well as a few radio stations. This week, I want to take up some monsters that are always in the news, which are the sort of tech billionaires like Peter Thiel and Elon Musk and Marc Andreessen and David Sacks, and in particular their relationship with the media, and in some cases what was once a surprising relationship that they had. One time, I would say, radical voices who have now really aligned themselves with the tech billionaires. I'm talking about people like Glenn Greenwald and Matt Taibbi. And to talk about all this, I'm very happy to have on returning guest Owen Higgins, author of Owned, How Tech Billionaires and the Right Bought the Loudest Voices on the Left. The book has been out for a while now, but is very timely because these characters are always in the news. And maybe we'll start with like Peter Thiel, because I think he gave a kind of interesting interview at the New York Times recently, where with columnist Ross Douthat. And at one point, Ross Douthat had asked them, well, you know, you do want the human species to continue. And Thiel, which is a fairly simple question, and Thiel hemmed and hawed and had actually a very difficult time giving a straightforward answer. I mean, I think he eventually came to yes, but I think it's, in his case, qualified in a number of different ways. Who are these like tech lords, and why are some of them like Thiel not so sure, you know, whether they want humanity to continue? Perhaps so. First of all, Owen, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and let's start with that question. Like who are these characters?
Yeah, I think Peter Thiel is an interesting one, and as you said, you know, he is in the news right now after that interview with Ross, and you know, he's a longtime kind of conservative activist slash VC guy. So he's a co-founder of Palantir, which is a data processing kind of surveillance company that works alongside of the federal government. It gets a lot of contracts from the federal government. He co-founded PayPal with Elon Musk before that. That's how he made his money in the first place. He's an early investor in Facebook. He has his fingers in a lot of pots, I guess you could say, if that's the right phrase there. His investments have paid off in a lot of ways, but and he's been somewhat like relatively apolitical there, where he's contracted with the government quite a bit. But his ideological commitments, his politics have always skewed pretty far to the right, going back to his college years. And he kind of has this conservative tech utopianism, where he believes that tech is going to kind of save the world. And Marc Andreessen is a lot like this too, specifically. Mm-hmm. I think kind of everybody in Silicon Valley is tech utopian to one extent or another. Thiel's is kind of very specifically right wing. It's targeted to this kind of a kind of far right vision of the world, where there's kind of like this idea of post humanism, transhumanism, where, you know, humanity can kind of dismiss the reality of the physical world, or at least like our physical world as we experience it. Teal is also famous for injecting himself with the blood of younger people in an effort to stay young. However true that story is, the fact that it exists in the first place kind of speaks to his reputation.
Yeah, well, I mean, he is very interested in longevity, as some of these characters are. He has famously said that he rejects the ideology of death. By which he means the ideology of death means like the biological fact that we all die, and he thinks that like there's no reason to accept this. And you know, at a particular point, I think in the 1990s, he and a lot of other people in Silicon Valley were interested in things such as cryogenics, which were, you know, with a view towards freezing their bodies and extending their lives forever. But I mean, I think more broadly, one can, you know, like post-humanism is a phrase that gets thrown around. And I think it's more broadly, one can say that Thiel and these other characters all have a kind of variation of the sort of going galt fantasy. This is the fantasy of Atlas Rand's famous libertarian screed, Atlas Shrugged, where the rich get tired of being the producers, the makers, and getting taxed by the takers and the parasites. And so they go off and, you know, create their own utopian society away from the rest of humanity. And one can see like variations of going galt in things like sort of psionics, right? Like where you freeze yourself and you'll wake up, your head will wake up, you know, 500 years in the future in a utopia, so you don't have to deal with the current world. But also in Elon Musk's idea of colonizing Mars, of creating, and it is specifically a political utopia, of he and his libertarian followers will colonize Mars and make it separate. You see the same variation in other ideas of like seasteading, which Thiel was interested in, of basically creating these like shipboard utopias that are outside of international law and where he can be the kind of king. And I think the sort of longevity stuff is a variation of that. So I think more broadly, you know, one can see a spectrum of ideas, all of which basically amount to we're going to exist as a separate master race apart from the rest of humanity.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of summing up their belief system. It's interesting to use Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged as kind of a way in here, because I also think of, and I mentioned this in the book, Teddy Roosevelt's Man in the Arena speech, which and the part that I isolate is about the media, but it's the speech overall is about how. Or the Man in the Arena section of a longer speech, which is kind of about how, you know, those who do, and those who can't do just criticize, you know, like that. Mm-hmm. So if you criticize what the tech guys are doing, you're just a hater. I mean, that's how they see it. Like they see themselves as worthy of a level of adulation that they never feel that they're getting. Their politics are kind of based in this resentment. And I think that it kind of sums up a lot of their belief system. And when it comes to things like, you know, a cryo or, you know, like the blood exchange stuff, or this guy who is always trying to find a way to be younger. He's trying to like make his body younger. Like that's like the new frontier for these guys. And they consider themselves to be pioneers. And so they think that tech is going to develop a way for them to live forever, or to at the very least live longer. Mm-hmm. And this kind of just goes into their broader belief system, this tech utopianism, which in kind of the next stage of it makes them believe that whatever they do is justified. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to that kind of a mentality, there is a belief in like the meritocracy, kind of like that, you know, we got here on merit and hard work, even though that's seldom the case. But that, you know, this is the self-mythologizing that they've done. And if they got there on merit, you know, anybody who's getting there on any other way, and they usually use this like against like affirmative action, is doing it like, you know, they're cheating, they're getting a hand up. It's not my fault that I'm a white guy and I had success. Like, you know, like that's just, you know, I just happen to be more talented. And I think that I don't really have to spell out, right, how this kind of
naturally goes to
racist politics and like and far right politics.
I know. And it particularly is striking in the fact that a lot of these characters are you know, actually like white South Africans.
Three out of the four that we're talking about here. Sax and Musk are from there, and Teal spent some time there when he was a child.
So I mean, I, you know, very clearly benefited from, you know, like an overtly racist the system as part of their, you know, generational wealth that they had started off with. So we don't need to like underscore that. And, you know, this type of rich person, you know, who thinks that they're the producers and it resents everyone else. I mean, this is an old character in American life, but, you know, the robber barons were like that. But certainly, like, you know, the rise of tech has created this new class of robber barons. What I think your book, you know, delves into is this other side of the story, which is that how they're not content with simply being like, you know, wealthier than anyone who's ever lived. And they're not content with having enormous sway over the political process and of both parties. They also want to control the cultural space. You mentioned this aspect of resentment, which I think is like very key to their personality, and one sees it in all their writing. Like they kind of like very strongly like feel like, you know, why are there people who don't appreciate how great I am and who are critical? And I think that, you know, there's obviously a psychological element. I think that there's also like a kind of economic element in that sense that I think a lot of their economic models in Silicon Valley are based on sort of like venture capital and investment and in creating like selling like these like sort of pie in the sky proposals, some of which like Facebook pan out and make a lot of money, but a lot that go nowhere, like that Theramos, that sort of blood transfusion thing that Mark Andreessen invested in, or like all the stuff that Musk has been saying for many years, like, you know, selling, saying, you know, we're going to get driverless cars any day now. You know, we're going to, Musk has repeatedly said, you know, we're going to be in Mars in 10 years, which he's been saying for, you know, more than 10 years. He's saying this in 2015, we'd be in Mars by 2025, and we're nowhere near, you know, getting anywhere near Mars. And honestly, like, realistically, like, we're not going to be there in decades, many decades into the future. But you're raising money with these kind of like pie in the sky proposals. So if that's your business model, then any sort of journalism is actually threatening, because you get like these journalists that are starting asking questions like, is this blood system actually working the way that you are claiming it's working? Or is this like, you know, you're using fraudulent science? So I think these two components, this personal component of a psychological resentment against criticism and a business model that, you know, requires no journalism, maybe explains why these characters are interested in this. Do you have any other thoughts on that? Or
yeah, I think that it's very much about the material interest. I think that's the primary focus for these guys. And I want to kind of piggyback on what you said about venture capital. Yeah, like they are interested in investing in all of these different things. They are interested in hyping them up for their own gain. Musk is maybe the king of this, right? He always makes these huge promises for what his companies can do. They seldom, if ever, deliver, and it doesn't matter. He continues to just make money hand over fist, mostly on paper because of the valuation of his companies. But you know, like it's still happening. People are still believing in it. And I do think that they are concerned about journalism, because it both exposes them psychologically in ways that could damage their investments. And I think that there is the venture capital side of that, but I want to talk about the more important aspect of how Silicon Valley became so powerful, which is government funding, right? So you have venture capital, you invest into this company, but the way that the company often makes a lot of money is through government subsidies or outright government contracting. And when I mentioned Thiel earlier, I said that, you know, he made a lot of money off the government. and he's ideologically to the right. Right. So these are two things that are not as contradictory as you might think that they are. In that, Thiel, for example, like genuinely thought Barack Obama was a communist. He genuinely thought that he was an authoritarian socialist. But that did not stop him from making money off the Obama administration. It did not stop him from contracting with Obama. It did not stop him from Palantir taking tons of money from the companies that he's invested in, making money off of a Democratic administration. And while a lot of these companies did quite well under Trump in the first term, they didn't like lose their contracts under Biden. They still continued to work with the government under Biden, even as they were saying all of these things about him. That and look, I don't think that the federal government in a country that nominally has free speech, right, should make your contract dependent on like whether or not you agree with the president, right?
Sure.
So I don't have like a problem with them continuing to in that manner, right? Continue to contract with the government. I don't think that there is a fundamental issue there. But what I do think is important to note is that if you're going to be saying all of that stuff and continue to contract with the federal government, like that hypocrisy does need to be exposed. Mm-hmm. And in the exposure of that hypocrisy, journalists will often find out other things about these individuals that they definitely don't want to be revealed. Like Elon Musk's alleged drug habit that's been reported on.
Yeah.
Right. I think there was some reporting that he was getting tipped off to drug tests. Mm-hmm. Before they were happening, right? Like these are allegations. I don't think this has been definitively proven yet, but a couple of people said that this is what's happening. Enough of that kind of stuff, and it's possible that under a functioning government, you might lose your contracts. For Musk, the real fear that he'll lose his contracts is because of the capriciousness of Donald Trump and like him just deciding that he wants to cancel the contracts. Whether or not that would actually happen, I think, is a different conversation. But their concern is that when they're not just having just nonstop adulation by the press, that when the press is looking at them critically, that it might impact their bottom line. Whether it is, as you say, like the VC side or whether it's the government contracting side, anything that can damage their bottom line is something they don't want. So anytime that there's a journalist who's asking any kind of questions that they don't want, they react poorly to it, and they have for decades, and kind of like that process of them reacting poorly to it and you know the kind of alternative right-wing media ecosystem that they built out of it is kind of, you know, the argument of the book.
Sure. Yeah, no, I mean, to sort of like build on that, I mean, there's another aspect of like Musk where he wouldn't want reporting, which is that a lot of his contracts depend upon security clearance and like access to high level information. And, you know, there was reporting, which apparently is one of the causes of the rift with Trump, that Musk was trying to get a hold of Pentagon information was not part of his purview. And so stuff like that, I mean, like is an actual real material threat to them. If you, you know, get reporting that, you know, like a major government contractor is, you know, like acquiring security information that they shouldn't. I would also add like on a broader, like ideological level, like, you know, if you get like enough reporting, I think it does open up like questions about like their whole role in society. That is to say, if their wealth is based as it is, like, you know, like on government funding and often government research, then like the question is like, why do we have these billionaires? Like, why are they allowed to profit off of this? And there's a kind of like neoliberal model of, you know, public private cooperation, but like, you know, like if something like the iPhone, you know, like it was largely created by like, you know, state funding, and you have like an alternative model of, you know, like a nation like China, which funds a lot of its own research, but the state controls, then why, why would we like allow that to continue? Why not just like cut out the middleman and just have state funding and that the wealth is controlled by the state? Like, I think that's actually also a real threat to them. Like, if you people start raising questions about like why are they allowed to exist?
Yeah, the I wonder how much of a threat they really think it is, just because the danger of the U.S. government like walking something like that back is probably pretty low.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's not like an immediate threat. But I mean, it does seem like it's like any sort of reporting does kind of like open up these questions, you know?
Yeah. I think that when they see things like Mamdani winning in New York, right? When they see people like Bernie Sanders, AOC, Ilhan Omar, other left-wing voices talking about a more economically just kind of, you know, like more maybe nationalized economy, to the extent that these figures really talk about that. I mean, we are still in the United States. But I think that they kind of see it as something that is terrifying to them. And I do actually want to just go back to calling Obama a communist. I mean,
yeah. Well, I mean, that's why I was thinking along this line. Like, I think that even like the very mild form of like, you know, like redistribution of like Obamacare, they see as like a massive threat. With I mean, maybe there's an element of paranoia here. But I think there's also like a more realistic sense. Like if people do get a taste of like, you know, like we could actually like, you know, change the rules, and that, you know, like the enormous wealth that these guys have is actually just a function of policy decisions, and we could have a different set of policy decisions. I actually think that they are legitimately right in like fearing that. Like that is not a conversation that will work out well for them if that becomes the center of public debate.
It's not a conversation that works out well for them, but it's like it's an own goal, because if you call someone like Barack Obama a communist, then you're kind of diluting the power of that word if you're going to try and make it a bad thing, right? If you call AOC a communist, if you call even Mamdani a communist, I mean, these guys, they're not projecting a vision of politics that is actually that damaging to private industry. They are projecting a vision of politics at the moment that sees private industry as in a partnership with the state. It's just one that is kind of less of this kind of Reaganomics vision that we've been under for like the last 45 years. That's only gotten worse and worse, right? Like, they're just saying, hey, like, let's kind of like wind this back a little bit. And I think that if you continually like fearmonger about that, you are diluting the kind of extremism of that word and that ideology to the point that, you know, people, as they're growing up, younger people are kind of more susceptible to these arguments. And eventually you have more left-wing politics coming out of it. I mean, I do really believe that if the right, and here I'm not talking just about like the tech guys, but I'm talking about like the right-wing media and right-wing politicians, if they hadn't freaked out like they had over Obama, and you know, like called everything he was trying to do socialism and communism and kind of any other word they could slot in there other than black to say why they didn't like him, that, you know, essentially by the time that someone like Bernie comes around with his argument, like it's a populist argument that the American people are primed for anyway since like 2008, but like the idea that a democratic socialist is running is no longer as terrifying, because they have put in place this kind of like they've hyped this up and fearmongered about it so much that it has actually had this kind of reverse effect that they maybe did not intend for.
Yeah, no, I want to actually build on that, because I think it's a really interesting rhetorical turn that one now sees with Mamdani, where like Trump has said, you know, he's not just a socialist, he's something far worse, which is a communist, which to my mind basically means that like Trump is seeing that, oh yeah, socialist, like, you know, that's an acceptable politics, you know, like, you know, like people associate with Bernie and stuff that they like, but, you know, like he's actually something far worse. He's a communist. So I would imagine 5 years from now, people are going to say, like, you know, well, this guy's not just like a communist. He's like a Maoist. You know, like, you have to keep upping the rhetorical ante as these ideas get normalized. Once we bring in this, I think that's a good point to bring in the other half of your book, which is the journalism side of it and some of these characters, because one of the characters in your book, Matt Taibbi, has weighed in on this controversy about Mamdani, and he has written very harshly against Mamdani and saying that this is a new level of crazy in American politics, and that we have someone who's talking about, you know, taking over the means of production, and really sounding like Bill O'Reilly or like an angry Fox News grandpa. And this is, anyone who's followed Matt Taibbi knows, like, maybe he is shifted in his politics over the years, although he denies it. But it seems like a particularly significant change, considering that this is Matt Taibbi is a guy who made his fame, writing about Goldman Sachs in 2008, and suddenly, you know, he's making the sort of standard right wing argument this is a communism.
Yeah, I think that's a standard right wing argument. Pretty much sums up everything Matt Taibbi does now. Yes. There's nothing particularly interesting about his writing anymore. Mm-hmm. This kind of like wonkette for edgelords style that he has, that, you know, back in the late 2000s was kind of a good way of explaining the financial crisis to, you know, people and kids in college and other people too. I mean, I think that a lot of his reporting back then was very good, and his politics were quite obviously to the left, no matter what he says now. I mean, mm-hmm. it was against this kind of corporate control, this corporate power, against the financial kind of politics that or the financial control of politics that today he's now arguing, I think, in favor of, whether he's doing it explicitly or not. Going after Mamdani in the way that he did is something that, you know, I mean, it sounds like Mark Levin, who is this kind of, you know, just mm-hmm. particularly insane, but, you know, but just a Fox News conservative, you know, yeah. And that's kind of like what Matt does now. If you go to his Twitter feed, it's just him ranting about vaccines and trans issues and Russiagate. I mean, it's and you know, still talking about Russiagate like 9 years yeah. later.
Yeah, which Trump also does. I mean, like, if Trump wants to deflect from Jeffrey Epstein, he says it's just like Russiagate.
But the vaccine stuff is like 5 years old. I mean, like, you know, the Mamdani stuff is relatively fresh just because it's something he hasn't been just talking about for however many years.
Yeah, and it's something that's actually in the news.
That's actually in the news, but this isn't even like particularly new itself. He went after Howard Zinn for Thanksgiving, you know, a few years ago, just talking about how America's awesome and, you know, like how dare you say that it's not good, and like, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. No, actually, let's step back about Matt Taibbi, because I think you are wearing an agreement that there has been a kind of evolution, but maybe it's worth stepping back, because I think one of the things about your book that's very good is that it gives a very fine-grained analysis of the evolution of two of the major figures, Glenn Greenwald and Matt Taibbi, showing both of them starting off with perhaps not a standard left-wing position, but maybe like a left libertarian, anti-establishment, radical position, and then, you know, like evolving towards something that's much more in conformity with, you know, sort of like just the Fox News Republican ideology. So with Taibbi, I mean, like, you know, like I think, you know, you let's flesh out his evolution a little bit. You know, I think you rightly point him as an example of a Gen X figure, born, I believe, in like 1970, and really coming out of an age in the sort of like 1990s and the sort of cynicism of the end of history moment of, you know, the Clinton presidency, and making his name, I guess, as a writer first in Russia. So do you want to talk a little bit about, you know, who where Taibbi's coming from?
Yeah, he had a kind of what sounds like a bit of a wild, boisterous youth. You know, like had to go to a couple, or I think one reform school. Went to NYU, then went to Bard.
He's a bad boy. He's a bad boy.
Hey, you know, I'm a high school dropout. I get it, man. Like, you know, like, yeah, like, yeah, I'm not, I'm certainly not judging him at all for that. Goes to,
and it's also a bit in that sort of Hunter Thompson tradition, right? Like, you know, so someone who's like in journalism, but has this anti-establishment attitude, this sort of, you know, drugs, rock and roll.
Sex, drugs, rock and roll. Yeah, definitely. Although his father is a pretty well-established journalist, so he does come from it with a certain amount of family background. You know, he goes to Russia, bounces around a little bit. He goes to Mongolia, I think, and is like a professional basketball player there for a little while. and then he eventually finds his way to The Exile, which is this kind of satirical expat, American expat newspaper in Moscow during the Yeltsin years, as the country is kind of descending into this anarcho-capitalist vision of like what's going to come in place of the USSR after it falls. This publication is definitely sex, drugs, and whatever kind of music. There's a lot of, they write a lot about getting pretty high and drunk and consorting with young women. I'll put it that way. Now, they have said that this is satire, and I'm not going to stand here and tell you that I think that it is real or not real. I'm just going to say that, but in order to understand Taibbi, you kind of have to understand that level of the way that he was writing about this stuff was pretty misogynistic, him and his writing partner, Mark Ames, and satirical or not, a lot of this stuff did not age well. Taibbi and Ames end up kind of like breaking up. Their partnership breaks up. I don't think they've ever really reconnected. Taibbi comes back to the U.S. He works for the New York Observer. And then he, around the 2004 election, and I think by the very end of calendar year 2004, he joins Rolling Stone, where he writes about politics, and he develops a large following doing that. He has a very strong voice in the way that he talks about this stuff. And the financial crisis hits, and this is kind of like the perfect crisis for him and his talents. He's in the right place at the right time. He coins the Goldman Sachs as the vampire squid, sucking the life out, the money out of everything. From there, he goes to First Look Media, which wants him to kind of form a more financially focused publication, kind of like in parallel to the founding of The Intercept, which is kind of concurrent with this. That doesn't work out. He goes back to Rolling Stone. And in 2016, after Trump gets elected, Matt is very critical of this kind of Russiagate conspiracy theory that liberals have invested in. I think particularly, and this is kind of my take on it, because I was very opposed to this as well, like this idea that like from like the liberal side, that they didn't want to kind of face up to what had just happened and like why Trump had won. And it was much easier to say, hey, this happened because Vladimir Putin like stole the election.
Yeah, right? No. I mean, I think that's actually a very, really crucial part of this story, and I think with both Taibbi and Glenn Greenwald, who's the other major figure, they start off from a position of like being to the left of liberals and having a real legitimate criticism of the Democratic Party establishment, which God knows deserves all the criticism it can get. And with the Russiagate stuff, I think, you know, has largely their position you know, like largely makes sense. I mean, I do think you can find some evidence that perhaps there was some Russian support, but certainly not of Trump in 2016, but certainly not enough to like sway the election. And it was used as a deflection to, you know, like basically not have a self-critical analysis of like why Hillary Clinton lost to Donald Trump. So you know, like that's not even like nitpick. Like he was coming from a, like actually like a very good and valuable place.
He was. But what I would say is like that. And I think that just for listeners, if anybody doesn't remember just how like wild it was at this point. You know, the way that the Democratic media apparatus was treating this, like any conspiracy theory that you wanted to say about Russia would get you on TV, basically. And there was an incentive there for people to go further and further and further with it. And for about a year and a half, 2 years, things were pretty dire, especially MSNBC was a big vector of this. CNN a little bit, too. I think I remember New York Magazine, Jonathan Chait, said that like maybe Trump has been a Russian agent since the KGB, like picked him up in the 80s when he visited Moscow. Like, that's how crazy things were at the time.
To mention the Chait thing, because he like literally said, you know, like, you know, has Trump been a Soviet Russian agent since 1987? Yeah. It would be irresponsible not to speculate.
It would be irresponsible not to speculate. Yeah. Rachel Maddow was another one. But anyway, not to digress too far into this.
I think, as you mentioned, you were a critic on it. There were other people who were very critical of that, but you know, did not end up becoming Fox News conservative. It is the case that he was starting from, you know, like a an appropriate response to a case of like liberal excess and really liberal like fear mongering and fantasy politics.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that where kind of I diverge from him and Glenn Greenwald as well is that like eventually that's no longer interesting to me. And like what's going on with the Trump administration is far worse than this. The reason that I was invested in pushing back on this is like, I was like, look, the Democrats are like, they're what there is right now for an opposition party. And like, they are wasting their time with this stuff. And so like, that's like why in my view, it needed to be pushed back on, because you need to have like some like level of reality as you're pushing back against like the horrific policies that the Trump administration was pushing forward. But for Matt and Glenn, for Glenn, certainly, I think that there was like a lot of just like antipathy towards liberals, and that just kind of, and that's for a lot of reasons. And I don't know if we'll have time to get into that, but for Matt, he did try to do a reset with his liberal audience. And that was this book about Eric Garner, victim of police brutality, called I Can't Breathe. Now, this came out in, I believe, October 2017.
Yeah.
And as he was promoting it, like there was a whole book tour plan, and like this was going to be like his, really, like there's no other way to look at it like than like this guy wanted to do a big reset with his liberal base and kind of get back on their good, like, hey, we can disagree about Russiagate, but like let's, you know, the anger toward him from a lot of liberals was already existing, and a kind of right wing operation, media operation to delegitimize him, went back to his writing about women in the exile, especially, you know, during this moment of Me Too that was going on at the moment. And they kind of used this to not only torpedo that, but to try to torpedo his career. And Matt felt really betrayed by this, really betrayed that nobody was sticking up for him, that like nobody was supporting him. Walker Bragman, reporter, as I note in the book, like he did a whole investigation into these allegations of like, you know, not at the exile, but like his other work, that he was like abusive to women, and like found that they were pretty much unsubstantiated. But it didn't matter at that point. The book tour had basically been canceled. The book, I don't think, sold very well, although, you know, maybe it did, but it certainly wasn't like this huge success, I think, that he had hoped that it would be. And his reaction to this was to get further entrenched into liberals bad, worse than conservatives kind of territory. And that kind of set him up for this kind of like right lean as kind of kept on getting further and further to the right. And then by the time that we arrive in 2020, when COVID hits, he's kind of primed to be a right-wing actor. And COVID, I think, kind of pushes him over the edge. And then, of course, there are Twitter files a couple of years later that they kind of like, complete the process. But I would say that COVID and the vaccine stuff is really kind of that was where, you know, this shift that had been going on for a while kind of like went into overdrive and he went all the way to the right.
I think that that makes sense. I think it's good to emphasize the role of kind of like audience, and you know, the fact that, you know, like after the Me Too stuff, he was like looking for a new audience. And I mean, you know, the Me Tooing of Taibbi is a complicated story, in the sense that, you know, as you mentioned, like, you know, there's actually no serious allegations that's been substantiated of like actual activity. You know, having said that, he wrote some pretty horrifically misogynist stuff, you know, like in the exile, which, you know, like, you know, and which is like legitimate subject for criticism. So they put an awkward situation.
I want to be very clear that when I say that the allegations haven't been substantiated, I'm neither defending nor condemning him. I'm just saying that Walker didn't find anything there.
Yeah,
like that would indicate that there was like some serious abusive behavior.
Yeah.
But you're completely right. His writing was bad enough.
But
he wasn't Harvey Weinstein.
But I also think that the writing was very bad, but I think it's also the case that the accusations were also weaponized against them by, you know, people like, you know, like, you know, like Cernovich or whatever.
Yeah.
Who are like, you know, like clearly, you know, very sinister characters and by liberals who, like, you know, like, I don't think would have given that stuff much attention if it weren't for the fact that he were a critic of Russiagate. So in a sense, like, you know, like I don't think he's totally wrong in thinking that he was ill-served by that, in the sense that like the level of his cancellation was like far out of proportion of like whatever sins, and it was done for other reasons. It was done by people, you know, on the right who didn't like his politics and liberals who didn't like his politics.
I totally agree. Yeah.
Now, having said that, I think that where he ends up, and this will have to be like the last point, but I think it ties back in with the right wing tech lords, which is that they created this new ecosystem where they could be of great help for someone like him trying to recreate his career by, you know, with institutions like Substack, with his new relationship with Twitter and the Twitter files, which, you know, gave him a new kind of saliency. So the tech lords were ready to, you know, like take notice of his right wing turn and then, you know, like make him an ally. So I think the aspect is not just tech lords, but that the model that they're creating is a very audience-centered model, which on one level you might think is a good thing, but actually makes someone a prisoner of their audience, with the sort of self-radicalization that one sees on social media, where, like, you know, like if you get hit from spreading COVID conspiracy theories, then you have an incentive to spread a lot more COVID conspiracy theories, because that's how you will get subscribers. So the economic, you know, status aspect of it is also a part of this story. Like, it's both an ideological evolution and within this sort of media ecosystem that rewards this right-wing turn.
Yeah, that's a huge part of it. And when Musk selected Taibbi to kind of report on the Twitter files, these very carefully curated, self-selected documents from inside the company that kind of pushed forward this story that Musk wanted to have put forward, Taibbi was one of the people he picked, and he said that he picked him because he was like this independent journalist and he knew that he would do a good job. But the reality is that David Sachs, a fellow billionaire, is the person who suggested Taibbi, much like Mark Andreessen, another fellow tech billionaire, was the person who suggested Barry Weiss, because they knew that these guys were somewhat pliable and would tell the story that they wanted. And what you say about audience capture is totally right, and it completely applies here. You have Taibbi. The first story that he publishes from the Twitter files are about the Hunter Biden laptop, right? I mean, like, this is like not really a real story, like the quote unquote suppression of the New York Post story about it. But this is the whole thing. Like, there were stories within the Twitter files that were somewhat interesting. Notably, The Intercept had one on the whitelisting of certain like State Department aligned accounts. But this was. This was just like red meat, right, for the right wing. And there was a reason that he decided to do that. There's a reason that he selected that. That was because that's what Musk wanted to do. And I think that Taibbi also knew that his new audience was going to eat this up. And, you know, the audience incentives of Substack have led Taibbi to continue to tilt further to the right. And I think that is a large part of why he's still so invested in the conspiracy theories around the vaccine. He's still talking about the Twitter files and Russiagate. And I think that's why, just to bring it full circle, why he wrote this thing about Mamdani, because he knows that his audience is like these kind of disaffected conservatives and the tech guys who have supported his career and where it is now. And he is going to continue to kind of toe the line, as opposed to kind of go back to his roots as a more left-leaning journalist, more left-leaning pundit.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think to wrap up, Owen's book, deals with Taibbi and his relationship with the sort of like tech billionaires like Musk. And there's also a section which we don't have time to get into about Glenn Greenwald, who has had, you know, like a somewhat similar trajectory, but, you know, with significant differences. And as I said before, like, I think a really strength of this book is the kind of nuance of actually reporting out these stories and giving the sort of, you know, how these evolutions happen and how these relationships are formed. It's a very can't recommend this book highly enough. Like, it's actually very illuminating for understanding both the political economy of the tech world and how it's changing media, and very well reported out. On that note, I would just encourage everyone, if you've enjoyed this conversation, go ahead and get the book, because you'll be very well rewarded with a great read. And I want to thank Owen for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1 pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to aero hit to yoga and mobility, to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.